You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 18th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson, and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, is the US prepared to face a world without a nuclear deal with Iran? We'll look at the special envoy to Iran as he tours the Middle East, paving the way for a Plan B. Also ahead, who will take on Viktor Orban? With Hungary's Prime Minister determined to stay in power, anyone taking him on in next year's elections will have their work cut out. We'll also discuss the future of Iraq after the country's early parliamentary elections.
Keep in mind that a lot of Iraq's population is under the age of 25. Two-thirds are under 25. They do not remember anything before 2003. And so the Sadrists are sticking to their base.
Plus, Emmanuel Macron contemplates his electoral strategy ahead of next year's presidential race. We'll assess a predicted move towards the right. And we'll look back at a decade of Monocle 24 with our long-standing producers.
I think we still have this special bond. We have those shared memories of what it all was like in the beginning. It was very busy. It was very exciting. And it's interesting. I haven't really listened to that many old shows, but when I listen to them, it brings me so many memories back.
And we go through Monday's papers too. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Reports from Belarus say the French ambassador, Nicolas de Bouillon de Lacoste, has been ordered to leave. He's reported to have been vocal about human rights abuses. The US doesn't know the location of 16 American Christian missionaries and their families who were kidnapped in Haiti on Saturday. And the Iraqi agricultural ministry says that because of a water shortage, it'll reduce by half the area in which winter crops are planted this year. The Iraqi officials have complained that neighbouring Turkey and Iran haven't allowed enough water to flow into the rivers. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, is the United States readying the world for a future without a nuclear deal with Iran? The Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, has so far refused to restart indirect talks with the United States in Vienna. And the US special envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, is in the Middle East to discuss the stalemate. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by Scott Lucas, who's Emeritus Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. Good morning, Scott.
Very good morning, Emma.
Good to have you with us. Now, just tell us, he's going to the UAE, Saudi and Qatar, and that's about the sum of what we know, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I hate being an analyst to say I don't know where Rob Malley is, but the State Department announced last Thursday that Malley's trip would begin on Friday the 15th, last till the 21st. And there's been not a peep out of the State Department, out of any U.S. official, and interesting, not a peep from Gulf officials. So, you know, it could well be that Malley is just simply, in, as it were, preparatory discussions, that the big talks begin today and last throughout this week, or it could be something has happened behind the scenes we haven't yet known. But although I can say I don't know about that, we do know that the Iran nuclear talks will be the headline item on the agenda. But that beyond that, there are a lot of issues in the Middle East that the media may not pick up on that Malley may also be discussing, from Syria to Lebanon to Yemen.
We'll make sure that we pick up on those in a moment. But first, let's focus on the Iran nuclear deal. This is a deal which has been bubbling along back in Vienna for quite a while, but there is still this dreadful stalemate that Iran is not engaging in direct talks with the United States. And it's gone from the stage of manageable to a situation now where some are saying this is a sign that this is not going to happen.
Well, to boil it down to the basics for me, in June, which was the last set of talks in Vienna, the sixth set of talks in Vienna, Iran's deputy foreign minister, who was their lead negotiator, came out of those talks and said, we're closer to the end of the road. In other words, he was saying, look, we have the vision of an agreement on U.S. reentry into the nuclear deal. The U.S. left it in 2018 on the lifting of American sanctions and on an Iranian return to compliance with the terms of the deal, ensuring that it does not pursue a nuclear weapon. And then Iran effectively blocked the talks. They did so initially because of the election the managed election of the new president, Ebrahim Raisi, who is seen as a hardliner. But then even after Raisi came in early August, this harder line that the government took meant that they continued to say, no, we're not going back. We're not ready. We're not going back. We're not going back to the talks. And the latest over the weekend is two different messages from Tehran. The foreign minister, the current foreign minister, met with parliamentarians. And one parliamentarian says, oh, okay, they could be back in talks with the powers that are still in the agreement, UK, France, Germany, China, Russia, by Thursday. But another parliamentarian said that for any talks involving the United States, there's a precondition. The Americans have to lift some sanctions before the Iranians come back to the table.
And what is the likelihood of the U.S. doing this?
Slim and none. Even though Robert Malley is a strong proponent of talks with Iran, has actually been seen as a relative moderate on the issue, not only on the nuclear talks, but on Iran's position in the Middle East. The idea that the Americans, being so concerned about Iran's nuclear program, having just said through Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, through his trip to Israel, through his hosting of the Israeli foreign minister, that there must be a plan B if Iran does not talk. No, this has to be a mutual agreement among not only the United States and Iran, but other powers as well, that yes, U.S. sanctions can be lifted when there are Iranian guarantees that it will not enrich uranium to the point where it's capable of having a nuclear weapon.
So what role do the neighbors now play? I know that Rob Malley has said that Saudi Arabia, the UAE, all of the countries on the Gulf Cooperation Council are now interacting with Iran in the way that they wouldn't have done, let's say, 6 years ago or 5 years ago. What is Malley hoping he can get these Middle Eastern nations to do or say?
It's more to manage them not to do certain things in this very careful balance. And the first part of this, which you'll get from the media this week, obviously, is, look, you know, we don't want the Saudi Arabian in particular, which has been the main rival of Iran throughout the Middle East, to take preemptive action. We don't want an escalation of tensions, certainly no talk of military action against Iran's nuclear program. And the Saudis will be fine with that. The Saudis will, you know, although they talk tough about Tehran, they won't want to basically up the temperature. But the second balancing act is the one that the media might not notice as much. And that is Iran and Saudi Arabia have been in talks over the past few months, particularly in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, about a rapprochement. Now, this is not as much talks about the nuclear issue as much as Iran and Saudi learning to live together over the Yemen conflict. Iran and Saudi learning to live together over the absolute catastrophe in Lebanon and over the Syrian conflict, which has gone on for more than a decade. And the Americans, on the one hand, would like to see a more stable Middle East, but they will be a bit wary of Saudi Arabia and Iran drawing too close diplomatically or even easing tensions before a nuclear deal is reached.
Let's say this deal does not come together. And we look at the United States, which, you know, looking at President Biden, he said, you know, diplomacy is going to be the way that we now do business. What will the world view of the United States be if diplomacy fails here?
Well, I mean, some parts of the world will probably think that this shows a relative U.S. tough line after the disaster of the Afghanistan withdrawal. And that will include elements of people in the Gulf states. They'll say, look, at the end of the day, the U.S. not reaching a deal with Iran might be a good thing, that Tehran can't push the Americans around. Israel will certainly probably see it as satisfactory. And even the Russians and the Europeans are wary of Iran basically getting too much leverage in the talks. But beyond that, I think the interesting question will be, what does it mean not about the nuclear deal, but about the region? And that is, will the Biden administration actually deal with the wider issues that have already been there? Will it show a line which tries to protect civilians in Syria? Will it show a line to try to get Lebanon out of a nightmare where the country is almost bankrupt? And will the Biden administration with others finally get a lasting ceasefire in Yemen where millions are at risk of starvation as well as the damage of war? You know, the nuclear issue has always been a pawn on the Middle East chessboard. Even if the Biden administration can deal with a pawn, are they ready to deal with the chessboard in a productive fashion?
One thing also that's happening is that Iran is independently going off and cozying up to Russia. We have the chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces is in Moscow at the moment and is talking about the President Raisi's look to the east policy. How much is Iran just getting on with its own business now?
Well, Iran has to look east, because especially if they don't reach a nuclear deal, they'll be in perpetual economic tension and some would say crisis. Their economic and financial routes are cut off to the West, to Europe, to the United States, and even limited with neighbors like Turkey. So they'll say, look, we can go to China, we can go to Russia. The thing is, right now, this talk of an Iran-Russia partnership is all coming from Tehran. You know, the idea that they said in the past few days, a strategic relationship, you know, military cooperation, but also billions of Russian support for the Iranian economy. The Russians aren't saying that because they have their own economic issues and because the Russians are playing a balancing game. So, yes, the Iranian military is in Moscow this week. Guess who else is in Moscow talking to Vladimir Putin this week? The Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett.
And it gets more and more complicated. Right, let's cover these other countries that you said are not being mentioned in the headlines. Syria, Lebanon. What are those discussions going to be about with Mali?
Well, Mali has been someone who early on tried to, when he was in the Obama administration, tried to pull the Obama administration back from intervention in Syria to really protect civilians. We have the situation now where Syria is three different countries, the Assad regime area, a Kurdish-held area, and an opposition-held area in the northwest backed by Turkey. Will Mali tell the Gulf neighbors, look, this is the fact, that Syria is three countries. We recognize that. We will not allow Russia and the Assad regime to try to overrun the Kurds or overrun the opposition in the northwest. Will he draw that line? And also, what position will the Gulf states and the U.S. take on a country like Jordan, which is beginning to ease diplomatic and economic relations with the Assad regime after more than a decade?
Scott Lucas, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist.
Every week, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from all around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is a show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. So, set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS each week on Monocle 24, or download the latest episode right now at monocle.com, via iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. The Bulletin with UBS.
And you're back with The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson, live here from London, where the time is just nudging 7:13 a.m. Now, the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, will face a Conservative municipal mayor as his main opponent in next year's elections. Peter Márki-Zoya is seen as an outsider, leading a united opposition against Mr. Orban, who for the first time since he came to power in 2010, faces a single united group of parties that include the Socialists, the Liberals and the formerly far-right, now centre-right, Jobbik. It is the only way, claim the opposition, that they stand a chance of unseating a man whose grip on power has reached into the heart of Hungarian society. Well, Politico's Lily Bayer joins me down the line. Good morning, Lily.
Good morning.
Very good to have you. Just tell us, who is Peter Márki-Zoya?
He's a very interesting character. He spent most of his career actually in the private sector, and he was elected mayor as an independent in the southern city of Hódmezővásárhely in 2018. He is conservative, Catholic, the father of seven children, and really an unusual character to lead the Hungarian opposition. But this is what Hungarian opposition voters have opted for in a primary. Last night we got the results, and he won over 56% of the vote in a runoff.
His opponent, Chiara Dobrev, I mean, how does she feel about this?
She congratulated him last night. She won the first round of the primary. She got 34% in that round where there were five candidates. And what happened then was quite unusual in the sense that three candidates moved to a runoff vote. But one of them, the second place candidate, the popular mayor of Budapest, Gergely Karácsony, actually withdrew from the race. He is a liberal-leaning politician with green credentials. He withdrew and he actually endorsed Márki-Zoya, the conservative. And that was because A lot of politicians and also voters on the left and liberals believed that Matt Kizai in the general election expected next year has a better chance of defeating Orban than the left liberal Dobrev.
What is it about Matt Kizai that people think will be able to not only take on Viktor Orban, but beat him?
I think a lot of people believe, and some polls have actually shown this, that Matt Kizai is placed to appeal to undecided Hungarians and also to people who have in the past voted for Viktor Orban's ruling Fidesz party, but have become somewhat disenchanted with his policy and politics. And because Matt Kizai comes from a conservative background, many people believe that he has the ability to reach out to some of these voters. And as you said, he is perceived as an outsider. He's someone who's vowed to try to change Hungary's political culture. So for voters who are unhappy both with Orban, but also with left-wing parties who have been in power in the past, he might be an interesting option.
I mean, could this united approach actually unseat Orban? I mean, they're bringing together the socialists, the liberals, the formerly far right. In fact, everybody is united against Orban. And the chances of getting rid of Orban are what?
Right now, the opposition bloc and the ruling party's bloc are polling neck to neck. One point that Matt Kizai made in his victory speech last night is that this is quite an uneven playing field. So the ruling party is incredibly powerful. They have access to a lot more resources than the opposition does. But on the other hand, Orban has been in power for over a decade. There are voters who are looking for other options. The opposition, I think, has been energized throughout this primary process. For the first time in a long time, we saw debates among candidates, people exchanging ideas, debating actual policies. And this is an interesting development in Hungarian politics.
What if Orban wins? Because that means that Orban has not just defeated one candidate, he's defeated the entire opposition.
Right. So one reason why the opposition has banded together is because they say that Hungary's current electoral system, which was actually introduced by Orban's government, favors the ruling party. So they think their best chance is to run together. And they didn't only hold a primary for the post of prime minister. They actually, earlier this fall, held primaries to pick out unity candidates in each of the country's 106 electoral districts. So the idea is that in every electoral district, there will be one opposition candidate. In some places, it's a liberal. In some places, it's someone center-right, and so on. And those people will be facing, you know, local Fidesz candidates. So it's a very interesting experiment. Of course, it's unclear if it'll work. But I think the opposition now is better placed than they have been in a very long time to actually pose a credible challenge to Orban's power.
This stretches so much further than Hungary's borders, though, doesn't it? I mean, we have Viktor Orban arguably wanting to be the leader of the right, the far right in Europe, with influences in Italy, influences in Poland. This is an election which does not just affect Hungary, is it? Isn't it?
Yes. So Orban has been trying to present himself as a kind of intellectual leader of the European conservative movement. He has been inviting a lot of far-right and conservative politicians to visit Hungary, and he has been building relationships with far-right political parties across the continent, and even also with conservatives in the United States. So what is fascinating, actually, about the opposition's choice of Matt Kizai is that now Orban is facing an opposition that is led by a conservative, and it might be harder for him to present himself as kind of a conservative voice when his own chief critic at home is someone who, in his own words, has been a conservative for much longer than Orban.
Lily Beyer, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's programme, we'll examine Emmanuel Macron's re-election hopes and we'll flip through the morning's newspapers. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Join Monocle 24 every day and let The Briefing guide and inspire you through uncertain times, always keeping you ahead of the curve. Hear razor-sharp insights and opinion from a lineup of brilliant minds every day.
It's devolving to a point where we're at odds with each other instead of letting our political leaders do the dirty work, so to speak.
Catch up with Monocle's bureau and correspondents around the world. Heavyweight coverage, no white noise, and always delivered with a smile.
I think the grey areas lead to a lot of sort of awkward conversations, and there's nothing the English dislike more than awkward conversations.
Every weekday at 1300 CET, midday in London, and 7 a.m. in New York City. Keep your appointment with The Briefing, weekdays on Monocle 24.
Keen for a quick tutorial on where you should take your business over the coming months?
The really brilliant products are brilliant, not because of a marketing campaign or it's because they've managed to get some incredible ambassador. They really are good because they add value.
Interested to learn how one of the world's biggest pharma companies responded to the pandemic?
We need what's called warm preparedness. So we need public health systems that have the supplies ready, at least for the initial phase of a pandemic.
Curious about the future of air travel?
Everybody's looking forward to connect with the world, connect with friends around the world, and just spend some leisure time and some relaxing time abroad.
Or wondering whether shops will still matter.
There's thousands of different journeys through the store that anyone who walks in could take.
From CEOs to editors-in-chief, CMOs to chief strategy officers, our series is a fast-paced, intimate discussion with chiefs, big and small, from around the world. That's The Chiefs, right here on Monocle 24, or wherever you find finer podcasts.
H22 in Paris, which is where we head next, because France's President Emmanuel Macron has wasted no time in getting on the campaign trail. For months now, every move or decision he makes is viewed within the context of whether it is part of an election campaign for the presidency next year. Well, now the pace is quickening, and to find out what could be part of a more concerted election strategy, let's hear now from Florence Biedermann, who's the AFP journalist in Paris. Good morning, Florence.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you with us. It's great to have you back on Monocle 24. Let's just sort of set things out first. Emmanuel Macron has not yet declared his candidacy, but it is a pretty safe bet that he'll be seeking re-election. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty a safe bet. And it's clear even since more than 6 months now. I mean, you are entitled to have two rounds of presidency, and it's clear from the start he would try to be candidate this time too. So you feel it also in a series, as you said, of decision he's making, like, you know, here and there he's giving money to some people to kind of improve his social credit. He's allowing hunters like to hunt some kind of species of bird in a certain way. You know, he's forgetting no one around. Like, it's kind of systematic campaigning.
And how is he going about this? I mean, many are saying that he is already beginning to build his election campaign team.
Yes, I mean, the team, I'm not certain it's really quite established now, but he has people around who have been following him and who have been campaigning for him even in the past. So definitely he will have the choice of the people he wants to take in. I mean, it's a bit early now to say who will be leading it. There are some names circulating, but nothing really confirmed yet.
Well, some are suggesting that the team that he is using is actually a group of former conservative insiders with lots of characters who are ex-Sarkozy team members, because he knows that it's the centre-right that he needs to conquer next year.
Well, I mean, it depends on how you look at it. The centre-right is already, I mean, his, let's say, strong point. He will try, of course, to have more credit with those people. Like, he will have to stand firm, for example, on such topics as immigration, because this is one of immigration, justice, police, you know, these are the strong points of the, let's say, more classic right. And his contender could be coming from this classic right. So that's where he had to be strong. Whether he does that with that kind of team or not, as I said, remains to be seen. And he also cannot forget his left, because, you know, he has been elected by a kind of a variety of people from the center left to the center right. So even if he keeps an eye on this topic, and of course immigration will probably be one of the important topics in the election in a few months, he still has to also be careful and to make a balance with a more moderate electorate.
How will he manage to achieve that, given the fact that everything that he seems to have said in the last 12 months and actions seem to be pushing further and further to the right?
Not that much. You know, I mean, there are also some, of course, for the people on the left, he will never be left enough. But for the people on the right, he will never be right enough, which means, by the way, that maybe he achieved what he wanted to achieve. I will give you an example. For example, this weekend, he took part in a commemoration of the massacre of Algerian civilians in Paris during the Algerian War in 1961. This is very, like, delicate story in France, you know, because it has been kind of a crime covered for decades. Nobody really heard about it. So he took part in the commemoration. He didn't say a word during the commemoration, but this is the first time a French president is taking part in such commemoration. So you see, like, it's kind of signals that are not only centered of, you know, lashing at immigration, or, you know, you have this hysterical campaign on the extreme right, like between Marine Le Pen and Eric Zemmour, who are really lashing at Muslim immigration, etc. He's taking a different stand. He's kind of playing the role like the head of state who try, you know, to face history and to make some gesture. And the only president who made a gesture on this topic before was François Hollande, who was a socialist. So, you know, it's more nuanced than that.
It's difficult as well for Sarkozy, given the fact that he came to power having arguably broken the establishment with his party En Marche. The difficulty is that once you break the establishment and are elected, you then become the establishment.
I mean, this is what happens to all the candidates, you know. Somehow, you if you pretend you're out of the system, like Zemmour is doing, like, you know, also some populists usually do, then yes, once you're in power, it becomes difficult. And once you have to make proposals on how you are going to govern, then the situation becomes more difficult.
Florence Biedermann, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. The time is just coming up to 7:28 here in London. A quick summary now of some of the news headlines. Reports from Belarus say the French ambassador Nicolas de Bouyen de Lacoste has been ordered to leave. He's reported to have been vocal about human rights abuses. The US says it doesn't know the location of a group of American Christian missionaries and their families who were kidnapped in Haiti on Saturday. 16 US citizens and one Canadian were visiting an orphanage when an armed gang seized them. And the Iraqi Agriculture Ministry says that because of a water shortage, it'll reduce by half the area in which winter crops are planted this year. Iraqi officials have complained that neighbouring Turkey and Iran don't allow enough water to flow into cross-border rivers. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, a matter of weeks after the United States abandoned Afghanistan to the Taliban, a parliamentary election in Iraq has been won by another enemy of the American state, the Shiite cleric and militia commander Muqtada al-Sadr. Al-Sadr's Siren Alliance was already the biggest party in Iraq's parliament, but it significantly increased its share of seats and therefore influence on Iraq's immediate future. Al-Sadr will not lead Iraq's next government, but no one will have a greater say in who does. Well, to find out what the future holds for the country, Andrew Muller heard from Renard Mansour, who's project director of the Iraq Initiative at Chatham House. Andrew began by asking how the next government can entrench some sense of legitimacy when just 41% of voters showed up at the polls.
Well, this has been the big story in Iraq for many years now. A growing portion of the population does not believe in the political system that was set up in 2003. If you look at the turnout in the first Iraqi election, the first one after regime change, it was almost 80%. It was very high. But each time, with every election that passes, the turnout has gone lower and lower. And that is because a growing Iraqi population doesn't feel that this government can provide the basic services, their basic needs for their daily lives. They think that elections in themselves have just proven to be a reinforcement of the same cast of characters. Iraq has gone through so many different types of conflicts since 2003, yet there's been no accountability, there has been no reform, and the same leaders continue to govern without any accountability.
The key figure, as we have been discussing earlier in the program, is, of course, Muqtadir al-Sadr. And though he will not be the next prime minister of Iraq because he declined to stand as a candidate himself, he obviously is even more entrenched in the kingmaker role than he was after the last election. Do we know who he wants to govern Iraq? Who is his preferred prime minister?
Well, first of all, I think we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves. He doesn't have a majority. He doesn't have enough to be able to form a government that he could actually run. Every time in Iraq, we've seen that the end result of government formation, notwithstanding elections, is consensus government, is negotiations back and forth. Now, you're right that the Sadrists have increased their seats and some of their competitors and opponents have lost some seats, which give them a bit more political power to in those negotiations. And as you say, the Sadrists have, in the last few years, developed an interesting technique, which is to put up independents, to put up these technocrats who are weak and not political, and instead to focus on the senior civil servants of the Iraqi state, to plant inside the Iraqi state powerful people who can then tell the ministers what to do or tell the prime minister what to do. So power in that way in Iraq has gone down, away from what we would think are the powerful people to the second layer. And that's where the Sadrists focus, and that is their game. And so this allows them to have scapegoats, to move away from accountability when they fail, and allows them to continue governing de facto. So it's hard to say right now who the Sadrists will choose, because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter for the Sadrists. Their key criteria is they want a government at the top level that is weak, that is unable, but critically willing to do whatever they want when it comes to contracts, procurement, and the daily politics.
Do the Sadrists and Muqtadir al-Sadr, do they have any sense of responsibility to the Iraqi nation, or are they mostly just concerned with looking after their own people?
I mean, very clearly that has become the name of the game in Iraqi politics, particularly when the voter turnout is low. The reason why the Sadrists are doing so well is because they have the base that will vote. So an increasing portion of Iraq's population is no longer voting. And keep in mind that a lot of Iraq's population is under the age of 25. Two-thirds are under 25. They do not remember anything before 2003. And so the Sadrists are sticking to their base. If you look at this past summer, the two biggest news stories from Iraq in terms of corruption and harm on society, one has been the hospital fires that have killed over 100 people in Baghdad and Nasiriyah in COVID-19 patient wards. The health ministry is largely seen as a Sadrist ministry. The other big story has been the lack of electricity, especially as, you know, the heat gets up to over 50 degrees this summer. Again, another ministry that is a Sadrist ministry. The Sadrists are playing just like every other political party. They generate revenue from the Iraqi government, from the Iraqi state, and they share it among their own patronage to ensure that when elections do come, they have a base that can vote. That money doesn't trickle down to most people, and even that process of corruption harms Iraqis.
If we reflect on those huge protests, which were one of the reasons, or actually the real reason, that this election was brought forward 6 months, one of the things the protests were about were this sectarian logjam that you describe. Indeed, also, though the comparison doesn't quite fit perfectly, but echoes of Lebanon there as well. Is there any realistic prospect of that changing? Is anybody going to end up in a position in the next Iraqi government, whatever it is, to actually get across the idea and make it stick that this is one country, we do all live here, and we do need to find a way to make this work?
I think if there's one lesson that we've learned in the last few years after, you know, these popular protests emerged, calling for real reform to that political system, the one lesson that we've learned is the political system is incredibly resilient and it can outlast protest. Not just outlast protest, but it has stomped on protest. You've seen for the last few years a systematic campaign of violence that has targeted activists, that have targeted leaders who could mobilize. You no longer have protests in Iraq in public squares because the system has stopped that. It's targeted any individual who could potentially mobilize in the squares. You've had the killing of many activists, the jailing of many activists across the south in Baghdad. So we've learned that the political system is resilient and it's here to stay. And protesters who emerged in 2019 calling for a change to that system have been silenced. And usually our conversation is very pessimistic or negative and critical, but there is a kind of, in my conversations with protesters and some of civil society activists this week, if you look at the election result, there are some positive signs. For example, some seats have gone to parties that came out of the protest movements. Also, there are a few, not all, but a few independents that are themselves surprised that they somehow won votes and are now in the parliament. The third highest personal vote went to a leader of the protest movements. So what you have is this loose coalition of protest-minded, reform-minded, truly independents who are now going to go into the parliament. But the question becomes, what happens during that very nasty horse trading government formation process? Can these protest coalitions stay together? They will be attacked. There will be the big bosses coming after them, and they will be isolated. To answer your question of, is there any signs of hope from the protest? We'll have to see whether this loose coalition of very weak but driven reform-minded protest leaders now going into parliament, whether they'll be able to withstand very strong political forces.
That was Renad Mansour there in conversation with Andrew Muller. To hear more about the future of Iraq, listen to the latest episode of The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24. Let's continue with a look at today's newspapers. Joining me down the line is the journalist and Monocle contributor in New Delhi, Lindy Prickett. Good morning, Lindy.
Good morning.
Let's focus on what's happening in Kashmir to start with.
Yes, unfortunately, it is not a great situation happening in Kashmir. Tensions have been mounting for many days now, as there are terrorist groups that are killing about, so far, 11 civilians for being non-Kashmiris. There's been 4 deaths in the last 2 days from laborers who have no work and so came to Kashmir, where things are starting to pick up, and tried to get some work there, but instead they lost their lives. There was a particularly gut-wrenching piece from the Times of India about a carpenter from the state of UP, Uttar Pradesh. His name is Sagar Ahmed, and he lost his job in the pandemic, so he headed to Srinagar where there was work. And his family were worried because the situation is tense, and he called his family and said, "Hey, the people here are so nice, and I want to find a good man for my daughter to marry, and you guys worry too much." Then there was a call a couple of hours later, and they thought, okay, what's Dad forgotten to tell us? And it was that horrible call nobody wants to get from authorities saying that he had died. He had been gunned down by terrorists hunting non-Kashmiris. Now, some of these deaths are from newly arrived laborers and migrants, and some are from minority groups, minority in Kashmir, I should say, because that's a majority Muslim state. There was a man called Siddharth Bindrus, whose family ran a famous pharmacy chain in the region. He was gunned down. Another incident was when gunmen stormed into a boys' secondary school in Srinagar and shot at close range 2 teachers, members of the region's minority Sikh and Hindu communities. Now, things have been tense because, as we know, you might remember a couple of years ago, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government split Kashmir into 2 federally administrated territories. And tensions have been high since then, as the locals, some of the locals, the fundamentalist locals, are saying, we are not happy about non-Kashmiris coming into our state and diluting our people.
Tell us just a little bit about who is actually being able to step in to try to address this, because to have people, sort of innocent souls, travelling to find, you know, husbands for their daughters and then being gunned down is just something which in many other circumstances would just be impossible to comprehend.
It is, and it's such a tense situation. And of course, the government's response is to bring in more soldiers, to get paramilitary and the police involved, which all sort of makes sense in a normal world. That's what you do. You bring in law and order. But as we know, things are so tense in Kashmir that many Kashmiris don't trust those authorities because there has been such tension for so long. Of course, the other side of the coin that people would point to is that a lot of the problems are coming from, of course, this is one of India's favorite tropes, but are coming from militants across the border in Pakistan, that Kashmir was a very modern, forward-looking Muslim state for so many years. It educated its girls. It was very progressive in its values and its ideals, and things have deteriorated in the last 20 or 30 years as the situation has gotten worse there. But I will say a little ray of silver lining. There was a story by a digital website, a digital magazine called Village Square, talking about how cycling has become the rage in Kashmir. Because of the pandemic, people were stuck at home, couldn't get exercise, so they took to their bicycles, and many young women took to their bicycles too. So more and more women are bicycling, whether they're going to school or they're going to work or just for fitness. So there are some rays of hope in the valley as well.
Let's move on to a meeting that's taking place today of what people are calling the new Quad, the United States, India, Israel and the UAE. A rather unusual grouping, but it's being held this morning, isn't it?
Yes, well, clearly quads are the new it thing in diplomacy. It seems like every couple of weeks we've got a new quad being formed. This is interesting because they're talking about Israel is talking about wanting India to play a greater role in West Asia, which is, you know, what we might call the Middle East and India together now. So this happens, as you said, the Indian foreign minister is heading to Israel right now for his first trip to Israel, in fact, S. Jaishankar. And in as part of that trip, there is this quad being formed to try and tighten relations. Now, a lot of people say that in the last few years that India's outlook in the Middle East and relationships with a lot of Middle Eastern countries has actually been on the up. Things have been improving. And so this is a good time to sort of catch that wave. But you're right, it's an odd grouping. It's the U.S. way over in the west. It's the UAE, it's Israel, and it's India sort of over on the eastern side of that, all trying to come together. Now, what are they coming together for? Well, as the Israel Foreign Secretary said, first of all, he called this a strategic earthquake. He said that he wants to look into how the new situation in West Asia can have an Indian angle to it, how India can be incorporated into emerging opportunities. He said the region is usually flooded with threats and challenges, but that's changed in the last year, and they want to look at how they can leverage some of their ideas and technology and manpower to try and create new opportunities. And big data is definitely on the list.
Let's move on to a perpetual issue for India, pollution.
Well, I have to say, right now, it is absolutely glorious here. It looks like an English day. It's a gray sky out there, but we're all very happy in New Delhi because it has been raining nonstop for the past few days. In fact, it's been the longest monsoon in ages. But the rain has actually cleared what was becoming the autumn pollution. Unfortunately, India is absolutely vexed with pollution. The city is unbearable at times. The pandemic brought some relief to that, but it's so bad that our children and we as adults have been wearing masks long before the pandemic. And it tends to trigger mostly at autumn because of, the Indian pollution problem is a multi-headed monster. There's not just one reason why we have pollution. Yes, it's vehicles. Yes, it's dirty diesel generators. Yes, it's a lot of the development and the road building and all that kind of building of infrastructure and schools and hospitals and malls that the West did a long time ago and India is catching up with. But it's also at this time of year, fires that are happening in the regional areas. And those fires are from farmers who they only have 1 or 2 acres of land. They don't have the luxury of letting the land lay fallow, letting the earth do its thing and reproduce a better mulch and better fertilizing the soil better in the course of a natural agro cycle. What they have to do is just burn their last crop, get the earth ready, plant new crops because they live hand to mouth. So on one hand, you feel for the farmers. On the other hand, boy, it's a problem that is attacking everybody, and it will be a problem that India will have to deal with in 30, 40, 50 years as the pollution takes its toll on this great demographic, our great budding workforce that will no doubt have massive health problems in the future. And that is what's happening now. The chief minister of Delhi, Arvind Kejriwal, has said that the neighboring states are doing nothing to curb the farm fires, and that the pollution, although we have had a little reprieve, of, as I've said, is set to just be as bad as ever. And we're all going to be back to wearing our masks and putting our air filters on in our house when we really want to be opening the doors and enjoying the temperature change.
Lindy Prickett, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 7:47 here in London. Let's find out what's making the headlines in the world of technology. Josh Coles is a researcher at the University of Oxford's Internet Institute and a regular voice here on The Globalist. Good morning, Josh. Good to have you.
Morning, Emma.
Right, let's begin with Facebook creating a metaverse. I think you may have to make sure that no one gets left behind with this.
That's right. Yes, the metaverse is a concept which has been doing the rounds for a while. A bit of a rebranding, I think, of what we previously referred to as virtual reality and augmented reality, or VR and AR headsets, which big tech companies have been looking at developing for quite a while. What maybe sets the metaverse apart is after the pandemic that we've all been through, and we've all realized that things like virtual work and even virtual socializing are a possibility. Maybe a lot of those functions, as well as just gaming, which has traditionally been part of VR, can move into this, what's been called the metaverse. So Facebook has been one of the ones to take this on. Obviously, they're well known for their popular social media apps, but actually they also acquired the VR headset company Oculus a few years ago and has been including that in its kind of suite of apps for a while. So the plan that Facebook has is to hire several thousand workers in the EU to effectively build this metaverse out.
Right. And how are they going to do that?
Well, their promise is to create 10,000 jobs in the EU, high-skilled jobs, to sort of win the future, if you like, when it comes to the metaverse. It seems like a pretty, because it's not clear quite what the metaverse is and how they're defining it. Clearly, there's a bit of thinking, I think, that still needs to be done around this. But also, it's a huge engineering challenge to create a reality, and you know, through a device which is roughly akin to what it's like to actually walk around the real world, you know, all the visual cues, sounds, and so on that we rely on. It's pretty hard to replicate in a digital way in a device that can fit on your face without weighing it down. So there's a huge engineering challenge, as well as, of course, the kind of conceptual and social challenges that Facebook is trying to have to think about as well.
It is one of those perpetual stories, isn't it, that virtual reality headsets, etc., are always just around the corner. How just around the corner are we with this latest development?
Well, it might be that the hardware now has caught up to the aspirations of the people like Facebook trying to create it. Of course, there is a subtext here as well, which is that Facebook is very keen to explore new areas of its business, particularly those that don't relate to its kind of controversial stances it's taken recently on content. Of course, we've heard talked about on the show the revelations from a whistleblower in the US about some of the unseemly goings on at Facebook. And so this is a brave new world, if you like, for Facebook to explore. And I suppose it's not a massive surprise that at the moment Mark Zuckerberg might wish that he was living in an alternative reality.
Let's move on to a story that's doing the rounds on Associated Press, at least, which is about Microsoft and its operations in China.
That's right. So Microsoft has announced that it will effectively close down its LinkedIn app in China. It acquired LinkedIn several years ago and has been sort of rolling out the sort of professional social network for a while. But at the same time, China has been cracking down on tech companies both within China and those operated abroad. And LinkedIn is the latest victim of this. Earlier in the year, it became clear that Actually, it was academic scholars who work on China studies have been getting almost like cease and desist notices from Microsoft, notices telling them, advising them not to talk on their professional profiles about some of their work that's more critical of China. And of course, that's not really tenable at scale with a social network where you expect you can speak your mind, and particularly academics want to talk about and boast about their latest publications. So that was the straw that has broken the camel's back in terms of LinkedIn in Microsoft in China. They have promised to release a slimmed down version of LinkedIn, which just has job boards and job adverts. But of course, as anyone who's been on LinkedIn knows, it's much more about that. It's much more about networking and trying to get the jobs and connect with people as it is about actually just applying for them. So I think this is a real step back for Microsoft in China.
Regardless of the merits and quality of LinkedIn, what does it say about Beijing's ability to effectively determine what the likes of Microsoft do and do not display on Chinese web, on their Chinese versions of their websites?
Yeah, it's clearly been a challenge for big tech companies navigating Chinese regulation. And it's only in recent years, I think, that China has really started to put its foot down in some of these cases and maybe has had the confidence to do so. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Of course, many social media companies or tech companies haven't really tried to play in China too much. Google has occasionally flirted with the idea of doing a Chinese-only search engine, but hasn't. And of course, other sites like Facebook and Twitter remain effectively banned in Beijing, so in China. So it's a challenge which each different big tech company is having to navigate slightly differently.
And indeed, Apple is having its own issues as well with Beijing.
That's right. We had reports last week as well that Apple has been forced to take down a Quran app in China owing to some protests from the Chinese government there. This is a very popular app which is used by many millions of Muslims worldwide, as well as apparently almost a million Muslims within China. And Apple hasn't commented on exactly what has gone on here, so we're not quite sure. But it seems to be a case that the app has been accused of spreading illegal content, probably not about Islam itself, given that Islam is a protected religion in China. But Apple has kind of pointed to this human rights standard, if you like, in terms of its policy, which says that sometimes we have to, make deals, if you like, or back down from local governments based on their requests. But I think it's really a case of Apple, frankly, trying to have its cake and eat it in China, where it relies on a huge production supply chain to get its iPhones ready for the rest of the world, and increasingly sells a lot of iPhones in China as well.
Josh Coles, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally on today's show, it's time to look back at the last decade as we celebrated yesterday 10 years of Monocle 24 being on air. To mark the occasion, we gathered some of the station's most important voices for a trip down memory lane. Our three longest-suffering producers sat down to reflect on the last decade. Holly Fisher, Marcus Hippie and Fernanda Augusta Pacheco remembered the intense beginnings of the project and what sets Monocle 24 apart.
Do you guys remember those kind of early days when we launched the station? It was very busy. I feel like we got to know each other very quickly.
I'm trying to remember the first days. It was so busy that I feel like it was so intense. I feel like I was working all the time. Obviously, it's quite complicated if you go and launch an international radio station that's 24/7. So for a reason, we were rather busy. I think there was a lot of young energy as well because we hired so many young people at the same time. There was an amazing energy in the building, and there still is. But I think it was just like we were in the same boat, and we kind of like worked for the same goal, and that brought us very close to each other. And I still feel like the original team, there are a few people over here, and I think we still have this special bond. We have those shared memories of what it all was like in the beginning. It was very busy. It was very exciting, and it's interesting. I haven't really listened to that many old shows, but when I listen to them, it brings me so many memories back.
One thing, as you know, I never worked with radio before. So, when I visited studios, I thought it was this commonplace, just a beautiful, cozy radio studio. But I think I discovered it's quite unique. I think guests, when they come here, they feel comfortable. We do receive emails from listeners and we say, come and visit us in the office. We'll give you a tour every day. You know, even now, you know, now the things are reopening again. People love it. They love to feel part of the world and they really enjoy our work. It's really satisfying, yeah. Actually, that aspect.
That's so true. In fact, just 2 days ago, Andrew Tuck, our editor-in-chief, was showing one of our listeners who'd come over from Peru, was showing him around the office, and it was just really nice to meet someone. He said he was teaching his son how to speak English by listening to the briefing.
That's amazing. I learned how to speak Welsh on the briefing. I mean,
it's, do you still remember those lessons?
I mean, actually, you know, maybe not. Maybe not. It is a harsh language, but I think I should ask Thomas Lewis here to kind of teach me again as well. But guys, another thing, I mean, the people we've met, I mean, Marcus, Holly, I mean, you spoke to amazing people. And who would guess, I've had an interview with the Brazilian former president Dilma Rousseff. I went to Paris to see Amanda Lear. It's just incredible people. I mean, film directors of your favorite films, it feels like a dream almost, you know. I think we and people respect the brand, you know. I think Monaco is a very respected, and that's why we managed to speak to those names as well. They respect the work we do.
But it's not just the big names that we've met. I just think it's the people that come. I don't know how they do it, but Monaco employs really great people from all over the world. And I just think whenever I go anywhere in the world now, I know somebody who's there or someone who can tell me about the place before I go. And I would say, even if I had never travelled with this job, the amount of people I've met from different cultures, different places, has expanded my world so much.
Look at us three. I mean, I'm a British passport holder nowadays, but I've also got my Finnish passport. That's where I was born, Finland. Fernando, Brazil, you are from England. How many other workplaces are there that are this international? I think we've grown more confident. I think we know what we're doing, and it's become very natural to use our bureau, to use our correspondent network. And I think it's always, you know, I really, really appreciate that we do have staff members working around the world. We have many people we know, and it's quite natural for me to come to the office in the morning, plan our midday show, for example, and then start making phone calls all over the world, call Japan, call Australia, call Turkey, call the Nordic region. And it's like, it's just a very special way of working. And it's like, I was working in Finland and I barely made any phone calls abroad. It was always something about what was happening in the Finnish restructuring of the Finnish pension system. So I think after that, like, it's amazing working in a place like this and just follow what's happening around the world.
You know what sets us apart, besides, as Marco said, how international we are? I think that's amazing. I think we are, in our coverage, I mean, optimistic without being glib as well. And I think when you look at the media, I mean, it feels depressing. I think Monaco's look at places where there are opportunities, but in a nice way. Not in, we know that there are problems in the world, but I think we like to give a sense of hope to people, you know, for them to open a business, to watch something interesting, even in difficult countries, you know. And I am from Brazil, which is going through a very difficult phase, but, you know, there are always interesting stories to be told about a country, and they don't necessarily need to be about tragedies, even though we have to cover those as well. But I think Monaco has this optimistic sense, which I really like and I identify with.
Fernanda Augusta Pacheco there, ending that conversation with Marcus Hippie and Holly Fisher about the last 10 years of Monocle 24. If you'd like to hear the celebration in full, listen to the latest episode of the Monocle Weekly. Just go to our website for more. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache, Paige Reynolds and Charlie Filmer-Court, our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London, and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye, thank you very much for listening, and have a great week.